This is a bit counterintuitive for barristers to speak while seated, but we're going to do it nevertheless. Let me welcome you all this morning. My name's Simon Pitt. I'm a barrister on Michael Green's list, and to my left I have Luke Stanistreet and Toby Mullen. A little bit more about them in a moment. But this morning's presentation is on the Civil Procedure Act and a practical look at how courts have used that act or implemented various parts of that act since it was introduced. Can I just briefly introduce the panel? I've been at the bar now about 10 and a half years. My practice is mainly commercial litigation, and I do all sorts of things with a focus on general commercial, bit of wills and estates, and corporations, various other things. And the two gentlemen to my left and your right are testament to the bar's ability to attract the best and the brightest. We've got Luke Stanistreet, who came from King and Wood Mallesons, and then he was an associate to the Honourable Justice Judd in the Supreme Court. And he's been at the bar now, I think, 4 years? Two?
Just over two.
Just over two, there you go. He's achieved 4 years of eminent practice in but two. And then we have Toby Mullen, who was a solicitor at Clayton Utes, and then again followed that very well-trodden path and became an associate to the Honourable Justice Neave in the Court of Appeal. And is now, like Luke, a very busy, successful commercial junior barrister. So we're going to guide you through the Civil Procedure Act 2010 and talk to you about various sorts of interlocutory applications that can be made under that Act, and a little bit about some traps and tips and tricks and pitfalls and various other things. The way we'll do it is I'll lead off with a brief discussion about summary judgment applications, and then Luke and Toby will speak to their parts. We will have a short coffee break in about half an hour or thereabouts, and then we'll gather again after that to have a bit of a Q&A. This is your session in the sense that we want to be able to give you a bit of feedback, answer your questions, and make sure that you come away from today feeling like you've got a bit out of it. So you're not just going to listen to us talking at you for an hour and a half. There will be a bit of Q&A at the end, but I would ask to that end that you do save your questions for that end session. So make a note of them as we're speaking. And I'd also just acknowledge Michael Green and his ability to pull a crowd, because this is a fantastic turnout for 7:30 in the morning, and it's again testament to his cachet of his stable of solicitors that he can access. So we're very grateful to Michael, and thank you all very much for coming so early in the morning. In terms of summary judgments, the old regime for summary judgment applications, at least in the Supreme and County Courts, is to be found in the Supreme Court and County Court rules. And I won't bore you with the details of that. We're here to talk about the new regime, if you can call it that, which is to be found in Part 4.4 of the Civil Procedure Act. The old rules in the Supreme Court and County Court rules seem to be still getting a run, but the first point I would note is that because the test under the Civil Procedure Act is supposed to be liberalised, if you were going to be running a summary judgment application, either as a plaintiff or a defendant, it would make sense for that reason for you to utilise the new regime, because it's a lower bar to clear, if you like, to be able to get that relief through the courts. More about the liberalisation, in inverted commas, of that later. In terms of the Civil Procedure Act, we know that the aim of that Act was to facilitate the just, efficient, timely and cost-effective resolution of the real issues in dispute. Just pausing there, has there ever been a better foothold for barristers to be able to shoehorn their arguments into? I've heard that catchphrase thrown around the courts with gay abandon, and it doesn't matter how bad your case is, you always seem to be able to harness that little phrase to be able to try to use it to your advantage. And there's always something in there for an argument that you propose to put. So it's a lovely phrase, and it's open to significant interpretation. So the driving force behind the changes was really a desire to rid courts of unmeritorious claims and free the courts up for the really good fights. And in that context, Part 4.4 of the Civil Procedure Act is a very, very powerful tool indeed. And it's just interesting to note Justice Croft, who delivered a paper in November 2010 at a workshop for judges of the Supreme Court, and he said, if the overarching obligations under the Civil Procedure Act are complied with, summary judgment applications should be rare and successful applications should be rarer. It doesn't really sit too well, in my view, with this concept of the new regime being more liberal and being able to be utilised to get rid of cases and impose a lower threshold or a lower bar for practitioners to clear. I've read about 25 cases prior to today's presentation which have used the new Civil Procedure Act summary judgment regime, and of those cases, 13 of the applications were granted and 12 were not. So Justice Croft's wish or his comments were not really, haven't really been borne out in the cases. There are a few that are getting up, so it's certainly not the rarity that perhaps he had in mind, but nevertheless, the cases were a mix of contract, tort, Australian consumer law, trusts, Part 4 of the Administration and Probate Act. So there's been quite a broad mix of cases which have come under scrutiny from the courts in Part 4.4. There is a paper that you will have received, and I'm not going to go through that in any great detail, but what I did want to do was just draw your attention to a few sort of practice points, if I may, and give you the benefit of my experience in running summary judgment applications. The paper steps through perhaps the most significant cases that I could find in terms of the principles that have been distilled from those various decisions. Justice Dixon gave a very good judgment in Otterden Investments and Portbury Developments, and there's an extract from there, from that case at paragraph 3 of the paper. And what His Honour did was sort of coalesce a few of the principles which had been distilled from an earlier decision of Justice Jack Forrest. And he sets them out. There's about there's six principles which he's set out there. And that is a very useful point of first reference. And it's a very useful checklist to look at as a sort of a barometer to see whether you're on the right track with an application. And I'm not going to go into the test in detail because there's all these sorts of, various words which are used, such as hopeless, untenable, bound to fail, could not possibly succeed, fanciful, etc., etc. I'm not going to go through that, but what I do want to point out was that it seems to be accepted now that if a claim would have been dismissed under the old regime, then it will be dismissed under the new regime. And in that sense, there has been a something of a liberalisation of the test for summary judgments brought about by Part 4.4 of the Civil Procedure Act. And notwithstanding one subsequent decision by the Court of Appeal, I think the prevailing view is now that there has been a liberalisation of the test. And the Court of Appeal, in the decision of Lysaght Building Solutions, which you might be aware of, has basically confirmed that. So first point to note, there has been a liberalisation of the test. Put simply, it should be easier now under the Civil Procedure Act to get a summary judgment application through the courts than under the old regime in the civil in the Supreme Court rules. The next point to note is Section 64 of the Civil Procedure Act, and this is very, very important, particularly if you are a respondent to an application for summary judgment. Section 64 is important because it basically gives the court a release valve or a way out. Even if it appears to the court that the summary judgment application has merit and that the claim has no real prospect of success or the defence has no real prospect of success, the court can still refuse the application if it feels that it would be better for the claim to go through the court and be tried in the usual way. And there's a huge amount of discretion vested in the judges to use Section 64 if they get the feeling that, notwithstanding a very powerful argument for summary judgment, there are reasons why that claim should go through the courts. And a useful example of that, which I'll raise now, is an application which I ran under using Section 63 of the Civil Procedure Act under Part 4 of the Administration and Probate Act. I brought an application on behalf of a deceased estate against a claim by a plaintiff and sought to have that claim summarily dismissed on the basis that it had no real prospect of success. And that claim was, the application was dismissed before Associate Justice Zammit, and then we appealed, and we appealed up to the practice court before Justice McCauley. And he's on a, unfortunately for the body of common law, his honour delivered an extemp judgment. This is the case of Story and Semmons, which is in the mentioned in the paper. So unfortunately that decision didn't make its way to Austlii, but nevertheless, what his honour said was that Part 4 claims are not particularly good candidates for summary judgment applications because there are so many factors that the court can take into account at trial. And Part 4 cases are really, they depend on how the evidence comes out at trial. A lot depends on the character and the conduct and various other parts of the plaintiff, the person seeking relief. And more often than not, judges can't get a very good grasp of that until they see the whites of the plaintiff's eyes in the witness box and really see that person being cross-examined, see their evidence, which is usually by affidavit, being put to the test. So notwithstanding the fact that, in my view, obviously I'm a little bit biased, we had a very, very good case for a summary judgment application, Justice McCauley thought that it was appropriate for cases of that type to go to trial, as a general rule. That's not to say that a Part 4 case can never be summarily dismissed. There have been instances where Part 4 cases have summarily been dismissed. But nevertheless, it's a good indication of where Section 64 can be used by a judge to say, look, okay, I hear what you say, you've got a really good argument for a summary judgment application, but nevertheless, I just feel that it's not appropriate in this case for summary judgment to be granted. And it's interesting because Justice McMillan, who's actually the judge in charge of the probate list at the moment, has kind of taken that one step further. And if you are into running Part 4 cases, it should be noted that Her Honour has started making directions for plaintiffs to give evidence viva voce, notwithstanding the fact that affidavits are prepared in advance of the trial. So you can find yourself in court after opening your case, calling your first witness, the plaintiff, and Her Honour says, I'd like to hear from the plaintiff viva voce. And that gives, in my view, although it's a difficult job for a barrister to lead evidence, cold like that, it does make sense, because the court has to form a view about that person, about their bona fides, and really get a good sense for the kind of person they are, the kind of relationship they had with the deceased, and so on and so forth. So I've deviated off track slightly, but nevertheless, Section 64 is one to look out for. If you are responding to a summary judgment application, have a look at Section 64, have a look at the case law that considers that section, because there may be some very useful arguments which you can use to be able to say, look, nevertheless, the court should exercise its discretion to let this case go through to trial. The next point that I would note is this concept of summary judgment is to be exercised with great care. It's the cornerstone of any good defence to a summary judgment application to sound the warning to the courts to say this power should be exercised with great caution, and it shouldn't be used as a tool unless it is clear that there's no reasonable argument, that there's no real prospect of success. And that is still very much a live argument. You can make that if you're responding to a summary judgment application. And it's also interesting to note that one of the arguments which gets a bit of traction in the courts at the moment is that if your claim or your defence as currently pleaded shows no real prospect of success, what you can do is you can actually ask the court to consider a claim or an amended claim. So you can say if your claim as currently pleaded can be amended to give rise to an arguable defence or an arguable case, then that can be a way through the application. So bad pleading is not fatal to an application at this point in time. So it's interesting that even though the power to exercise or the power to grant summary judgment has to be exercised with great caution, I'll withdraw that. There is still
even sitting down.
There is still obviously this notion that the summary judgment has to be exercised and treated with great care and great caution, but one has to keep in mind the fact that under the new regime, the test is supposed to be liberalised. And in LISA, the most recent sort of pronouncement from the Court of Appeal on Part 4.4 and the summary judgment regime, Justice Neave made a very interesting comment, which I've set out in paragraph 9 of the paper on page 7. In that decision, Justices, or the Chief Justice Warren and Justice Nettle, gave a joint judgment talking about the new test and about Section 63. And they really stepped through the history of the provisions, and they stepped through a lot of the salient case law, but their conclusions didn't really advance, in my respectful view, didn't really advance matters much at all. And what Justice Neave did was she came in at the end and made a very valuable pronouncement, and she talked about this concept of exercising the power with great caution. And she said, "I'm concerned that undue emphasis on the caution with which a court must exercise the power of summary dismissal runs the risk of reinforcing the historical approach to summary dismissal and may result in the legislative liberalisation of the test in Section 63 having little impact in practice." Just pausing there, it's a really good grab in my view, because if you are met with an argument from a respondent that this power has to be exercised with great caution and you have to be careful and be really, really, really careful, you can point to Justice Neave's decision and say, well, hang on a sec. That argument used to hold a lot of sway under the old test, but under the new test, You have to be careful of that argument because it runs the risk of just completely running over the New Test and going back to the Old Test. And what Her Honour said, in paraphrasing, is that let's keep an eye on the fact that this is supposed to be a liberalised test. And let's not get too hung up on the concept of caution and let's not retreat to that position. So bear that in mind. If you're responding to an application, bear that in mind. And it's a very useful pronouncement in my view. My last point, because I'm conscious of the time, is in relation to costs. If you've run these applications, you might be of the view that costs should be, that there's a practice or a rule that costs of an application for summary judgment ought to be costs in the cause. I was of the same view until I ran a case before Associate Justice Derham, and I put that submission forward. And His Honour challenged me on it. And he said, well, no, where do you get that from? So I threw a few cases at him, and he's declined to follow it. He's actually said that Section 24 of the Supreme Court Act gives the court an absolute discretion in respect of costs. There is no such thing as a normal practice, and any decisions to that effect from the past are no more than guidelines. They're certainly not rules. So I was a bit dismayed by that. But in any event, that's the case of Towercom and Fahua, which is mentioned in Section 16. So that's a little bit about summary judgments. I'm going to hand over to Luke now. And if there are any questions in relation to Part 4.4, I'll be more than happy to answer them at the end.
Thanks, Simon. Now, I can't remember whether I volunteered or drew the short straw to swing from the very sexy topic of kicking out your opponent's case early on under summary judgment to the overarching obligations, which, of course, deal with you fine people. And I think the inconvenient truth is that you're probably the wrong audience. It's not the middle of March, so we can assume you're not scurrying to grab CPD points. You're probably here because you're prudent practitioners and you want to learn more. The people who need to hear this are probably not here. But in any event, we welcome you and thanks for coming. Simon spoke about the overarching purpose, this just, efficient, cost-effective time of the resolution of the real issues in dispute. And I think the prevailing view early on was that was just a motherhood statement. It's all very nice and all the rest of it. But has it really changed anything? And when you look to the overarching obligations, which in the context of practitioners and their clients give effect to the overarching purpose, there's a lot of early, particularly Supreme Court trial division authority in the first couple of years from when the Act came in, to the effect that the obligations on us as practitioners are no different. They're really not any different. So all the Act did was gently remind you. But the court's powers to deal with you if you muck up, they are different. And in short compass, it's taken the natural progression of time for courts to get a bit more comfortable with holding practitioners to account. And that was one of the ultimate aims of the legislation. And it's not something practitioners like hearing. The good ones, it won't bother. It'll bother probably the people who aren't here. But that's essentially how it's played out. And we've been getting closer and closer and closer. Justice Jack Forrest has probably been, I think, the greatest champion. He's published something in the order of 40 rulings in the Kilmore East bushfire class action that I'm involved in, and I think you would struggle to find one where he doesn't mention the Civil Procedure Act. And I'm sure I'm doing His Honour no disservice when I say that he's mentioned in court that it's one of the few acts he actually still reads and knows anything about or wants to. And the other one has probably been Justice Dixon. And so we got to a point where we're getting closer and closer and closer, and then in late 2012, Justice Cairo in Kuek and Devlin, it's in paragraph 24 of the paper, started to get a bit tougher. The Act does not contain generalities and rhetoric, nor does it deal with abstract concepts of justice. The Act imposes specific statutory obligations on the court, the parties to civil litigation, the lawyers acting in civil litigation, and other persons involved in litigation, such as expert witnesses. And he goes on, the Act must be taken seriously by litigants and their lawyers. And then he talks about the point at which the court might say enough is enough. So we're getting warmer, we're still not there. And then late last year in Yarra and Oswald, a decision which you're no doubt familiar, was where it sort of came to the crunch and it finally went upstairs and the Court of Appeal got to have its say. Now, those who recall the case will know it was essentially about numbers of counsel and court books. And in the end, there was an okay number of the former, but not of the latter. There was voluminous, irrelevant and duplicated material put forward in the appeal books. And anyone who's had any experience in the Court of Appeal would know that that's a great way to make yourself unpopular from the start. But in any event, it was deemed to be excessive and cost orders were made. The case isn't just about counsel and court books, and at paragraph 33 of the paper I set out a summary of some of the key points. And when you look at, leaving aside the actual facts of the case, but the more general propositions and statements that the Court of Appeal made, it can't be construed as anything other than an open invitation for first instance courts to start getting tougher. Now, if you take January out of the equation, as we do in this game, it's only really been about 6 months since then. But, for example, some of the statements, the powers are intended to make all those involved in litigation accountable. The CPA prescribes that the parties are under strict positive duty to ensure they comply with the overarching obligations, and the court is obliged to enforce these duties. Judicial officers must actively hold the parties to account. And there was also some comments saying, judges, hang on a minute, don't be worried about embarking on an own motion inquiry. If you feel it's appropriate, we'll back you. Then they set out some suggestions for how judges might do that. Now, I should say that the real point was section 24 in that case, which was whether the costs were reasonable and proportionate. And I think that's something we all forget as practitioners, and it only takes you or a family member or a friend to have some involvement with the law to know that whilst we accept costs as part and parcel, unless all your clients are very wealthy corporations, and I suspect they're probably not, at least not exclusively, there's a bottom line for individuals and small corporations. I think we often forget that there's sometimes in litigation, whilst it's accepted to us, it's easy to spend a lot of money and get no real result. If you need a knee reco, you go to the surgeon, you give him $5,000 or $10,000, whatever it is, and you're going to get your knee fixed. You can spend $10,000 with a solicitor and get nowhere. And it's really small comfort for the solicitor then turn around and say, oh, it's the way the other side's approached it, oh, it's the court's fault. I think one of the messages I'd like to put out there is that keep your own house in order, but don't accept the other side running away with things. And I think Toby's going to speak to that a little bit about we're all in this together to make it more efficient, and delivering good value for your client is something you should do anyway. But when push comes to shove, don't just blame the other side. And there's some further statements about holding practitioners to account. Now, let's set out in the paper. Perhaps unfortunately, the only real consideration, or most of the consideration of the Civil Procedure Act since, has been by the Court of Appeal itself. Or you could say that's a good thing because they've basically said, oh, remember what we said in Yarra, and reinforced it. So on one view, actually, even though not a lot's happened at trial division yet, certainly in the Supreme Court, there's plenty of Court of Appeal ammunition that judges can use. And I think the other message is, if it hasn't happened yet, we're getting there. It's been a progression. It's in the post. And you don't want to be the one effectively caught with your pants down when you get a judge who really throws the Civil Procedure Act down your throat. The key cases that are set out in the paper, the first one is Eaton and ISS Catering Services, which I'll just touch on briefly. And It dealt with a few issues, but one of the takeaway points was that it deals with this issue as in there it was the context of in a no-win, no-fee situation where there's a reluctance to spend too much money early on. And if we cast our minds back, there were originally pre-litigation requirements in the Act that got kiboshed with the change of government. And there are some people who actually think they wouldn't have been altogether a bad thing, although we don't really have to worry ourselves with that. But I often find that I either get a case where there hasn't been a lot done or the other side hasn't done much, and you go to a mediation and it's a complete waste of time. And again, it comes back to something I'll conclude with, and that is having an eye to the strategy of the litigation. The first mediation should be a realistic opportunity to have a go at settling the proceeding. Now, not in all cases, but if everything's not in order, if everyone hasn't got the documents, if the pleadings are in disarray, the mediation is a waste of time. And you either go along yourself or you brief counsel, they're there for half a day or a day, the client's there, sometimes they've got a time away from their business, and it's a complete waste of time, because no one, or at least one party, hasn't wanted to spend any money. And Eaton gives some clear guidance that that's really not acceptable, and it's going to contravene the obligations to essentially get on with the job, narrow the issues, and try and resolve it. The second case referred to in the paper is Setker and Abbott, and I'll put my hand up on this one. The citation's actually to the Trial Division reference, not the Court of Appeal one, but that'll be fixed in the emailed version of the paper, which you'll get. This one essentially dealt with the shift in a party's pleaded case, and acknowledging that litigation can be unpredictable. You might get new counsel that might have some new ideas. That's at the point where, you know, your past counsel gets jammed, you've got to go elsewhere, and then you're tearing your hair out because new counsel wants to change everything. But leaving those sorts of things aside, in that particular case, what was eventually sought to be run was just so remote from what had originally been raised as the key arguments. And for me, the thing that stuck out was the issue of prejudice always comes up. That's, again, as Simon was saying, when you're looking for a good backstop for your arguments, well, prejudice is one. You say, oh, well, the other side's not prejudiced. In this case, they're not prejudiced. Court of Appeal said, well, that's not really the point. We don't really care. And so they've cast some real doubt on the, you know, that backstop argument of where's the prejudice. And so it's something that you just want to be aware of, that the courts are now starting to look at not so much the principles before the Act, but how the Act has influenced how we've always done things. And again, that's something Toby's going to speak to. There wasn't much in Wingfoot Australia and Javevsky, I'll probably butcher that pronunciation, but it was effectively in the same vein. In addition to the authorities that say you can't raise a new point on appeal, the Court of Appeal said, well, the Civil Procedure Act's relevant to that too. So we're starting to get this shift of not just in the obvious things that Parliament set out to change, like summary judgment, discovery and so forth, but we're starting to see how the CPA is really affecting the past authorities. Now we get to the fun stuff. In April this year, Hudspeth and Scholastic Cleaning, which has been kicking around before Justice Dixon, I think, that went upstairs, and the second respondent, relying on Yara, sought an order that the appellant's lawyers, excluding junior counsel, I was happy to see, pay its costs under the rules or under Section 29 of the Civil Procedure Act. Again, the Court of Appeal referred to its decision in Yara. The conduct in this case was around critical documents and not misleading. And take a deep breath. Second respondent was ordered to pay the appellant's costs, and senior counsel and solicitors for the appellant were ordered to indemnify the second respondent for 80%, so 40% each. So a couple of months ago, Affirm and Asilk were found to have engaged in conduct that led the court to say, well, we're not just going to let that lie where it falls, and you need to be accountable. And if that's not enough to make everybody at least consider the way they do business, I don't know what is. I said in passing that all this links into your strategy. Now, you're all probably great practitioners who have a really good approach to litigation. We all know people who don't, that like writing nasty letters back and forth and going on with a whole lot of nonsense. Even if you don't, I'd encourage you to be a bit more proactive in trying to get your opponents to see some sense. And I think that the cases tend to suggest, and it's dealt with in the paper, that in one of the cases in particular, that you put people on notice, and if they don't do anything about it, the court's going to be unhappy with that. So don't be afraid to, if you actually can't get any sense out of them, bring it to court using the appropriate mechanisms and get some judicial intervention, because judges are going to be more keen to intervene. I think some of the key things are getting pleadings right. Sometimes they've got to be amended, we know that, but try and get them right. The critical documents, I don't want to go to another mediation not having stuff that I need because the other side just wouldn't give them to us. It's a waste of time, frankly. And the costs being reasonable and proportionate. I tend to get, being at the junior end of the bar, I tend to get three types of cases. I get the last minute hospital hand pass where nothing's been done and I don't think the pleadings are that great and, oh, we don't have an expert. Oh, well, trial's in 2 weeks. Oh, well, there's not really time to get one. That's unfortunate. The real train wreck stuff. Sometimes, thankfully, but all too scarcely, I get a brief that comes at the last minute or near a trial where everything's been done perfectly. Whoever's running the file has put a lot of thought into the stages. They've got it sorted out. They've got their house in order. They've got the other side on board. And you can just pick it up and run with it. They're fantastic. I'd love more of those, please. And that's you know, without any council involvement. And then there are the cases that I've been involved early. And we can walk through it together and we can make sure that we can put the best foot forward at trial. And of course it might settle beforehand, but you do have to have trial in the back of your mind. It's a reality. And the decisions say you can't just expect it's going to settle early, don't spend the money, ease your way into it. So I think that the broad takeaway is not just do the right thing and or you'll get whacked. It is, how does this relate to how I run my litigations? And I think the biggest criticism that I have of a lot of lawyers is they're not very good project managers. You've got a lot of files, you're juggling stuff, everything's going all over the place. But you've got to really think hard about a matter early on, put the time into it, and make sure you don't fall foul of any of these obligations, particularly things like not handing over documents, letting the costs blow out, getting drawn into silly fights. Be proactive. It's appropriate to go for a summary judgment, go for it. If it's just a case of sending a letter reminding the other side, my favourite ones are the people who have accredited specialists on their stationery, because you can say, well, as an accredited specialist, you would know that your obligations and these sorts of things. So it's not all doom and gloom, but I do think we will see through the Supreme County Magistrates Court more judges and magistrates becoming more interventionist when practitioners breach their obligations. So with that, I'll hand over to Toby.
Yeah, given that it's about 10 past, what we might do is that it said in the brochure that you were going to get a coffee break, so we better honour that.